You are listening to an Awakening Zone presentation. We'll be right back after these important messages.
Welcome to InnerSpeak Soul Adventures, your consciousness connection. Jean Adrian and her guests will be providing you the tools to empower you in creating the life that you desire. Now, here's your host, Jean Adrian.
Good evening and welcome to InnerSpeak Soul Adventures, your ultimate consciousness program. Every week we'll open the portal to the field of pure potential so that we can walk together hand in hand into the universe of conscious creation. I am your host, Jean Adrian. It's my mission to bring you information from many sources to assist you as you make your choices and raise your vibration. Together, we are creating the new reality. And I'm thrilled that you've chosen to join me here on Awakening Zone, and I commit to you that I'm going to bring forward guests and information every week that's going to challenge you to grow, and I'll provide you with power tools to use as you do. Please visit my site, www.jeanadrian.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for my newsletter. You can receive a free subscription for the online version of my InnerSpeak cards. You can use these cards to help you clear away any blocks that are holding you back from creating everything you desire in your life. And if you'd like to experience the power of these cards tonight, you can just go into the chat room or call in on the show later on. At the end of the show, I'll be doing readings and clues. Now, our soul adventure tonight is into the dangerous world of fire service. We're going to take a look at challenge and our choices around what we create in our lives, and we'll look at it from the perspective of a woman leader in a man's profession. Gina Gelbach-Hall is an acclaimed motivational speaker, author, and coach with 25 years of emergency services experience, ranging from MT to firefighter to battalion chief. She holds degrees in fire science technologies, fire management, fire service management, and business administration degree with an emphasis on marketing and advertising. Gina is also a graduate of the Department of Homeland Security National Fire Academy Executive Fire Officer Program. And she lives in Las Vegas, Nevada, where she values time with her family and her two wonderful sons and her friends. She continues to inspire leadership and service. Others ignite the flame of empowerment within themselves and those around her. Her new book is called Fire Gal, Rising from the Ashes, and her website is www.firegal.net. Now, I first met Gina in 2009 at Steve Rother's annual event, the 09-09-09 celebration at Big Bear Lake, California. And she was talking about her work and her experiences, and I was immediately impressed by her message. So you can imagine how thrilled I was when I found out that she'd written a book, her life lessons. She's going to share that with us tonight. So welcome, Gina. It's great to talk with you again.
It's so good to talk to you, too.
And I just, I know that our listeners are going to really learn from your experience and from your book. So I'm really looking forward to introducing you to the Awakening Zone. And wow, you know, I can't imagine, making the choice as a woman to go into the field of firefighting. Why did you make that choice, and why did you decide to do that?
Well, you know, I always like to say, I always wish I had like a really great story about this, but I really don't. I kind of laugh because what I wanted to be when I was a little girl was a cowgirl, and who would have thought that would have turned into a firefighter?
Yeah.
But instead of cowgirling, I took firefighting. But actually, I started out, I was finishing up college, and I was in marketing with my major, and I took an ad to do some marketing for a non-emergency transport company here in Las Vegas. And part of the duties or the service they offered was that the drivers would medically transport these people to their doctor's appointments or hospital appointments, would be an EMT, intermediate or emergency medical technician. And when I got in there, it turned out the job was less about marketing and more about just keeping the business running on a day-to-day basis. And we were always short drivers. So the company actually ended up sending me to EMT school, and I was just like a duck to water. And I think that's where my true passion came out, is I just fell in love with the work, with being with helping people. And at the time, you know, I kind of transferred over to the emergency ambulance side of the house and was doing that for a while. But the benefits weren't really there for a long-term career. It's just, you know, if I'd gone up the ladder of EMS to, you know, from EMT basic to intermediate to paramedic, and kind of the mecca was to get on the fire department. So at the time, my boyfriend, who later became my husband, said, hey, you know, the fire department's testing me. Why don't you come over and test? And I thought, okay, I don't have a job lined up for after college. I'll go over and test. And I never thought at the time that that would end up being a 22-and-a-half-year journey after I got on with the fire department. So, yeah, it was kind of a wrong turn turned right.
So that all that transpired back in the 1980s, right?
Yeah, I graduated college in December of 86, and I started with the fire department at rookie school in February of 1987.
So how many women firefighters were there at that time?
Well, at the time I came on, there was about 300 firefighters on our department, and we had one woman who had come on about 5 years prior to the four women that got – there was four of us that got hired at the time in 1987. And so although I technically wasn't one of the first, I believe the four of us were really the first big impact in our department, meaning that, you know, I was one of the first women on my platoon. So, you know, we really were like some of the first trailblazers in the fire department as far as women.
Well, now, because, you know, firefighting is an interesting family to work in, because don't you work like shifts where you're on for days in a row and you have to like sleep in the firehouse?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's definitely like a family. I mean, you know, they call it the brotherhood, sisterhood. It definitely is. I mean, I would literally be at work at 7 in the morning, and I wouldn't get off till 7 a.m. the next morning. So I actually spent 10 days of the month living at the fire station. So we lived together, we ate together, we went on calls together, we had really basically a family kind of community in the fire station. So, I mean, we definitely, it wasn't like at work where at 5 o'clock you went home. No, they figured out who you were really quick. They got to know your good side and your bad side, just like any kind of family. You know, they had like an inside track. And so we did get very close in proximity, as well as, you know, just knowing each other very well in that community of firefighters.
So what was it like working with basically all men?
Challenging.
Okay, so you tell. Let's elaborate on that challenge.
Well, you know, I write in my book. In my book, I said, you know, I wish life had come with an instruction manual, and then I realized I probably would have never read it. So I wish I had read the book before I got on the fire department. You know, I came on kind of blurry-eyed and starstruck, you know, and kind of like, oh, this will be a fun thing. Never in really, in my wildest dreams, realizing what I really was taking on. I mean, I was literally 23, fresh out of college. You know, I'd had a few jobs. You know, obviously I'd worked for an ambulance company before I came on. You know, but I had really no big life experiences coming into this. And now I came into a field that I had no idea really at the time that women, having a woman in that field, was such an anomaly that it would be met with such resistance.
I think you said it. You went into the brotherhood.
Yeah. Oh, it was definitely the brotherhood. I mean, and things were changing when we came on. I mean, kind of in, I think they were kind of modernizing at the time when we came on. But, I mean, it was really a good old boys club, too. You know, it wasn't mm-hmm. just a brotherhood. It was a good old boys club. And, you know, this was their social network as well as their, you know, working environment. And now some woman comes in. So, I mean, they had no clue on how to really even act and interact with us women. And then there was no real planning on the side of management to what are you going to do with now all these women coming in. I mean, we had a single, you know, one bathroom that was like a dormitory type bathroom, you know, a line on one side, urinals, the other side was the toilet stalls, and a community, you know, a big shower with about three or four shower heads, and then a big old dorm room that was completely open where we all slept. And, I slept in shorts and my bra and, you know, T-shirt, and, you know, I'd jump into my turnout at night if we had a call. But, you know, I mean, it was like everybody was kind of like, well, what do we do? How do we do this? You know, and, I mean, at 3 in the morning, I couldn't, like, go, okay, I got to wait till all the men go pee, and then I got to run in there. I mean, firefighting isn't one of those where you can wait 2 minutes while somebody goes and pees, you know.
Right,
so
yeah.
I literally put my hands over half my eyes and run past the urinals as I ran into a stall. Went to the bathroom because I couldn't do every pothole on the way to the call. And I mean, you know, we
right.
just kind of adapted to it, but it was uncomfortable. You know, it was an adjustment for everybody. And we had some stations up to about 3 years before I retired that were just then, you know, like 20 years after I came on, that were just in getting remodeled to have separate facilities and separate sleeping quarters. So, I mean,
that's
it was
amazing.
20 years of dealing with that, you know. And you know, some people might say, oh, that's no big deal. You know, it's not a big deal if you're doing it every now and then. If you're doing it 10 days a month, you know, 120 days a year, year after year after year, it got old. It got old, you know. And
so how did the men treat you? Because, you know, because you were an anomaly.
Well, you know, I like to preface it this way. I say, you know, 10% were supportive. 10% were never supportive and never were to the day I retired. And then 80% are kind of the silent majority. But that 10% can truly make your life a living hell.
Yeah.
And what happened was I would get, I would not find any support to it. So I was kind of like sitting out on my own. Like there was an incident one time where, you know, we because it was kind of like a family thing, we had a kitchen table, and after lunch we would turn over all our chairs and put them on top of the table so we could sweep and clean up under it. And I turn over the chair, and there was a very graphic drawing of a woman's private parts. And it was on my chair. And like a family, you know, sometimes you always have the same chair you sit in. And I had always sat in that same chair. So there was no doubt in my mind of who that drawing was depicted in illustrated for. And I remember at the time, you know, looking at it just kind of humiliated, you know, and kind of like, oh, my God, what do I do? And everybody's kind of looking at me like, oh, what's she going to do? What's she going to do? And I remember, you know, just kind of reaching into my junk pile of emotions going, whoa. Not really
yeah.
knowing what to do. And I just started laughing. Like, oh, that's a big joke. Ha, ha, ha. And I remember getting out my pen and starting scratching it out with, you know, ink and, you know, crazy apes and drawings and everything. I think what was so isolating, though, is at the time I was a firefighter, there was 6 of us at the station, and one of them being my captain or a supervisor. And the supervisor saw all this go down and didn't say anything. There was no discipline about it. There was no, you know, talking to anybody about it. And so, I mean, it was just kind of this sense of isolation all the time, like being like, I'm thinking in my head as I'm scribbling, why are they doing this to me? What did I do? You know, I mean, this is terrible, you know, but not having really a voice because nobody was really backing you up either because they didn't really want you there.
without that voice of somebody saying, you know, hey, guys, that's not appropriate, or, you know, I'm not going to allow that at my station. Without that kind of voice or support, it became very isolating and very lonely for me. It is what it kind of became. And
I can imagine.
I mean, eventually, you know, not that incident, but eventually enough incidences, I actually ended up having to sue my department for sexual discrimination, which is a major decision to have to go through that, and a very far-reaching one, too, that I talk about in the book. But I like how my lawyer said, she goes, you know, discrimination usually, it can be one big incident, but usually what it is death by a thousand cuts. They're small little cuts. One maybe doesn't hurt. A dozen you can live with. You get up to a thousand, you're starting to bleed out. And it becomes very painful. And what happens is you kind of lose your perspective of self. You know, like, you start seeing, you almost put this armor on and you're always in this defense mode. And that's what it kind of came over these incidents, over time, that really mentally just wore me down over time.
So what was the tipping point where you'd had enough and where you actually did begin to speak up and become an activist?
Well, I know what time it was. During about the time I had filed my discrimination lawsuit and started that process, I became the first woman in our suppression history to be promoted to a supervisory rank, which is captain on our department. And so I got promoted to captain, and then right behind me, one of the gals that came on with me in 1987 got promoted. So two of us got promoted within about 6 weeks of each other. Well, although it was not a big deal, and it actually was met with a lot of hostility in our department, it was kind of big news in Las Vegas and where we were. And so we attracted some media attention. And so we had an article done of ours about our experiences of becoming, you know, the two women captains on our department. And as a result of that article, there was a huge, big backlash of emails that went around through our department, interdepartmental memo system, that were just devastating to me. And really were horrendous. I mean, and the backlash was so nasty as a result of this article. And without going into a lot of details, the details are all in the book, but just learning more. I'm giving you the Reader's Digest version of this, I should say.
Right.
for time. But I got all these emails, and I literally walk into a training room and people would turn their backs to me. They would, you know, I was having death threats. I was having, you know, hang-ups on my phone. It was a horrendous time in my life, to the point I became suicidal, you know, and having suicidal thoughts. And at the time, I didn't realize what significance this was for me, but I ended up printing out all 17 of these emails. And I remember spreading them out on my bed and just sitting there, you know, like almost in a kneeling position on my bed, just sobbing and sobbing. And I thought to myself, if I see these 17 emails spread around the bed going, I've got to do something or I'm going to forever be lost. I mean, I really kind of had that thought, you know, like something's got to change in my life. I can't live like this. I mean, I had a 6 and 8-year-old kid at home, you know, I mean, I just became a supervisor. I don't want this to be how I'm remembered or how my career is going. I need to make some changes. And I remember reading each of those emails, and they were like knives into my heart. But I started to see a theme as I got below the anger, below the nastiness. And I really started seeing that they had really kind of saw me as a lone ranger and not much of a team player, which was kind of surprising at the time. I don't think I really realized that. But, I mean, when it's there in black and white and in your face like it was, I had to acknowledge it. And then I had to say, okay, if this is what they're saying about me, what can I do to change this? And it was in that time, and I won't say moment, I think it was in that moment I made a choice to not be a victim, but to start being empowered in my life and moving forward. Now, that journey took several more years after that point, but I think that was this deciding point where I decided I don't want to live my life like this. This is not the legacy I want to leave. This is not who I am. This is not how I want to be remembered. And so that's when I really started making some real significant changes in my life.
And, you know, Gina, that's what I really believe is the biggest takeaway from this book that you've written, is that, you know, we are responsible for creating the reality that we want. And it was in that moment that you made the decision to start doing things differently, where you stepped into accountability and responsibility for making change. It was kind of like Gandhi said, become the change you want to see in the world. That's what you did. And so, you know, I think that the people who read your book can apply it to their own lives, and they don't have to be firefighters. But I think pretty much all of us have gone through times in our lives where we've been discriminated against. You know, I think probably with maybe few exceptions, at some point in everyone's life, you face this this dilemma of how to deal with the bullies.
You know, in school. I think it comes up all over the place. I think, yeah. You know, we all have grief in our lives. I mean, we all think of a death as a grief. We all think of, you know, major things as grief. But, I mean, just going into a coffee shop and have somebody being rude to you creates grief in our life. And we get a choice on how to deal with that and how we process it. And what I kind of learned after that whole incident, and what I really had to get clear about, is that the change always began with me. You know, and I had to kind of start embracing radical responsibility for my own behavior, because I couldn't sit around and make up a story about how bad the fire department was, because that wasn't working for me. I couldn't make up a story about, well, it's the lawsuit, because that wasn't going to get me anywhere. If I really wanted to be successful in my life, I had to realize that the change began in me and that I was radically responsible for what happens in my life. And as I started taking that responsibility, change really did start creeping in. And that's where I started realizing that empowerment, too, is a choice. You know, that I really started stepping into what I was kind of sidestepping before. Like, you know, obviously if that thing had happened, you know, the picture on the chair had happened, you know, 15 years later after I had done the lawsuit, I can tell you it would have been dealt with much differently, because I was older,
sure.
I was wiser. But more importantly, I was more empowered to be in action than I was back then. I was more in reaction instead of in action in my life. And I think those emails, although they were the lowest part of my life to this day, I think, they probably have given me the most growth in my life. And I think my thing out to people that read the book is that, you know, they think it's a fire department story, and it is. I mean, that's my backdrop to my story. I think we all have stories like this, that we have
Absolutely.
Some kind of trauma that happens to us that we have to overcome. And a lot of what I went through, I learned through doing group work with a lot of people going through many different issues, and I realized the commonality of all our stories. It really did. That we're really more alike than we are separate.
Absolutely we are. And, you know, each of the people who wrote nasty emails or who drew the picture on the bottom of the chair, they were all absolutely wonderful teachers for you, weren't they?
Yeah, I wasn't appreciating them too much back then.
I bet.
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. You know, I mean, I look back and I think, you know, without them, I would have probably never gotten the growth I've gotten thus far in my life. And I know that where I am right now is going to be radically different than where I'm going to be a year or two or 3 years from now, you know, because now I'm so much more comfortable with growth in my life and embracing it and moving forward and not getting stuck in my story, you know. And can I explain what I mean by story a little bit?
Please.
Okay, I'll take a good example. I got in a car wreck not too long ago, and I, you know, it was kind of a bad car wreck. In fact, I'm still recovering from just had shoulder surgery. But that was back in early September, and I'm talking about it with somebody, and I told them, oh, yeah, I was in this car wreck, and, you know, oh, yeah, I got injured. And then another person asked, oh, yeah, I was in this car wreck. I had this, you know, blah, 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 and yeah. And then about the third time I'm telling a story, I'm like going, wait a minute, I'm telling a story about how bad this wreck was to everybody. And it dawned on me, I'm creating a story about how bad this wreck was. I don't want to be remembered that I was in this bad wreck for many reasons. One, I don't want my body to be having this memory of I was in this bad wreck, because that doesn't help my healing. And then I don't want that to become an excuse to me not doing some things, because I was using, well, I was in this bad wreck, so I don't want to go do. No, let's be honest. You don't want to do it because of this reason. It has nothing to do with the wreck. You know, I was very clear very quickly that I was creating a little bit of a story around this car wreck I was in. Now, the car wreck had some real consequences. I'm dealing with them. But I'm not allowing it to be my story. It's not an excuse for me not to be doing what I need to be doing, like here right now talking to you. This is what I want to be doing. This is what I want to be remembered for. Not for that wreck that I had. You know,
exactly.
Everybody has things happen to them. That's truth. Yeah, that's, you know, water's wet, rocks are hard. You know, that the life happens. But I didn't want my story, I didn't want my lead out every time I met somebody that, oh, I was in the bad car wreck and I had it. I don't want that. It became very icky to me. And I realized when I was, all those emails came out and had that story, you know, when I hit my bottom with the fire department started coming up, I realized I had the perfect story. I mean, I was the victim, you know, the big bad fire department was the persecutor, and, you know, we had all this drama of flames and people hurt and injured. I mean, I had a great story. I had a hard time getting rid of my story. People wanted to hear it. No, tell me more about your story. No, I can't keep telling that story. It doesn't work anymore.
Exactly. You know, and that's one of the huge stumbling blocks that I think a lot of people have to actually figure out, and that is the fact that we're not our stories, you know.
No.
So you had to dive down into the muck and the mud to actually find who you really were.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, I didn't even have a bucket list. You know, I had lost myself so much that I didn't have a bucket list. I really didn't know who or what I was. All I had was this story, and once I told my story and everybody goes, oh, now it's nice. And then it was like, well, where do I go from here? I kind of actually lost my identity a little bit. So what the cool part about the hitting rock bottom was I made some really cool choices at the time that I didn't realize how empowering they were. Thank God I made them. And now, you know, I feel like I have a lot of opportunity out there and a lot of ways to go, and I'm not tied into the story. In fact, I even say in my book, I almost hate writing about the story, but I have to tell the story to tell you what the good stuff's about. So, you know, it's kind of a mix. So it's a mixed bag for me, you know, but the story is there mainly as a framework of where I was to where I want to be and go in my life.
Which is really perfect. And, you know, I think another thing that really jumps out at me in reading your book is how often so many of us, and I include myself in this bunch, we settle for less than what we deserve. We compromise our own integrity just to keep the peace. You know, and a good example of that is when, you know, you turned the chair over and you saw that drawing on the bottom and you minimized it. You know, you made light of it rather than going, excuse me, but
yeah, and,
really?
And, you know, I know. And it's a hard choice, because if you're not in an environment that supports you being yourself, it's a huge, big risk. And I think what happens is a lot of times we go for acceptance instead of respect. Now, if I had gone for respect in that situation, I would have said, okay. Now, back then in the late 80s, they didn't have camera phones and all that. But if I had been smart, I would have said, oh, wait a minute, let me go get a camera while I take a picture about this, because it's going to go to the human resources department in about 30 seconds afterwards. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I would have put everybody on notice. This is not acceptable. I would have done, this is the definitive no, this is not acceptable behavior, and you're not going to get away with treating me like this, and we're going to deal with this, and we're going to figure out how to never have this happen again. But I was going from acceptance. Because acceptance would be like, well, if I don't make a big wave, they're going to accept me. And then, you know, maybe they won't do it again. And the delusion was I taught them something. I taught them how they could treat me. And how they could treat me was to do drawings like that. And I would just laugh about it. Now, when I think about it now, I cringe. I think, why would I want to teach anybody that's an acceptable way to treat me? Because it's not.
Right.
It's not. But it takes a lot of growth, I think, and maturity, and I'm not talking in age, but just to really have a sense of yourself and realize that in every communication we have with people, we're training them on how to treat us and how do you want to be treated. And I'll tell you, that's been a journey for me. I just didn't wake up one day and I was like, oh, I'm an advocate. No, I had to really kind of get into the guts of what I wanted to do with my life and how I wanted to feel in my life to get to the point where I could really get to where I could demand the respect versus just going along and accepting.
Exactly. You know, and that's a hard lesson for all of us. And even when you think you've mastered that, it comes back up. I mean, in the not too far distant past, I had that same lesson brought back up for me. About, you know, how people can treat me and what am I willing to allow to take place around me. I had been hanging with a bunch of people who, really enjoyed, you know, judging other people. I'm just trying to be polite about this, but, you know, they made fun of other people. And I don't do that anymore. But I never once stood up and said, you know, that really isn't very nice, lady. She shouldn't be doing that. You know, why don't we, you know, if you need to do that, do it somewhere else. Don't do it in front of me or I got to leave, that kind of thing. So it just kind of went on and on and on for a while. And, you know, it just became the commonplace thing that happened when this group of people got together. And I just allowed it to happen. A couple of times I actually... I never really did the judging thing, but I would laugh at some of the things they said, which meant it was kind of like you laughing at that picture. It was encouraging it. And the universe finally decided, Gene, you're not getting the picture here, so I'm going to really make it real uncomfortable for you. And what ended up happening was instead of judging people outside this group, they started judging me. And... It escalated almost like a mob scene. You know, it started first, it was just little criticisms, little snide remarks and that. And then it almost turned into a marathon of, okay, well, let's see how many times we can make Gene wrong during the course of one of our lunches.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally, you know, just like with you, when it got painful enough, I had to stop and say, hello, you know, I love you all, you are my friends, but I will not tolerate this anymore because I'm not invested in being right. If you guys want to do that, knock yourselves out. I'm out of here.
It really is insidious, and we don't really realize sometimes what we're even doing, you know, and I've had some life lessons recently too, you know, without doing details, but the same thing of how me not addressing those issues right up front have come back to really bite me. So it really is, you really do have to stay on top of what you're about you know, and
yeah,
what you're
staying in
to
your
tolerate.
Integrity. You
know, I know. Integrity is hard work sometimes.
It really is.
I
and
mean,
you
yeah,
know, if you guys have joined, if you,
way to go.
Yeah, if you've joined us late, I'm Jean Adrian. This is InterSpeak Soul Adventures on the Awakening Zone, and I'm speaking tonight with Gina Gelbach Hall, and we're talking about her new book, which is Fire Gal: Rising from the Ashes. And we would love to hear your stories. Well, not so much your stories, your comments about integrity and how does it, you know. What does it take for you to stay in your integrity and to stay in your truth and be on purpose and in the now moment? Because that's really what this book is all about, is one woman's lesson when she was faced with challenges, and in many cases challenges that most of us probably would never have to go through because we wouldn't choose to be one of the only women in a male-driven or male-dominated occupation. So her challenges were big, and she could have chosen to let them drive her crazy, but she didn't. She chose
well,
to change it.
I did for a little bit. I came around, though.
Well, you know, you're allowed.
No,
we're all allowed a little bit of wallowing, aren't we?
Yeah.
So give us comments or questions. We would love for you to call in. The number is area code 714-364-4335, and I am monitoring the switchboard and the chat room. So I will take your calls and take your comments and questions as well. All right, so I'm sorry I interrupted you, Gina. So let's go back to what you were saying.
Well, one of the things I talked about in the book was gateway behavior, and it's a little bit about what we've been talking about, how sometimes opening the gate a little bit, we don't really at the beginning think it's that big a deal. But I use an example in the book about one of the stations when I became battalion chief, you know, as a new supervisor, I, you know, kind of sat back a little bit and kind of was watching how things had been running because I supervised 10 stations and 65 personnel. And so I was kind of getting a feel of how these stations operated and, you know, getting to know them, letting them get to know me. And one day I went into one of the stations, one of my larger stations, and they were all out on calls. So I got a chance to sit around and kind of look at the station from a very non-official standpoint, you know, in a more relaxed environment. And I got looking around, and they had all these magazines laying around the day room, which was our, like, community area in the fire station. And I noticed that although none of them were right out inappropriate, like a Penthouse or Playboy by any means, they were getting to the side of almost inappropriate. You know, like, one more, and it could be bad. Plus, it was just very, you know, cluttered and you know, chaotic looking. And so when the captains came back from their calls, I took them in the office and I said, hey, guys, you know, you need to pick up the magazines, you know, and clean them up and kind of thin them out for, you know, using some better judgment here. Well, oh, my God, this is a new woman, battalion chief, what is she thinking, you know, ruining our station? You know, and, of course, it didn't stop at the station. It's like it went through the whole department about how I was now going on a rampage on how I wanted to clean up all the magazines, you know. Oh, I just let the uproar go along because I knew after years on the department that there would be an uproar and then it would settle back down. So about the next cycle, I came by and, you know, they had complied with my order and I brought the captains in and I said, look, you know, you really need to look at them from a liability standpoint. You know, like you don't want a civilian coming in or a woman firefighter coming in and now lodging a complaint about you because these magazines are inappropriate. And two, it doesn't look like this is a well-run, you know, station either when you have clutter all over the place. And so they're like, they kind of grumbled with me, but they started cleaning it up. Well, I started noticing other little things that they came on my radar screen, you know, that some other things that they weren't doing, like their training records weren't up to par, their some other minor details that they weren't complying with. And I started putting them on notice for that. The funny thing was that once I closed the gate by addressing the behavior, that station actually really seemed to be functioning better. They were some of my model fire captains. They had some of the best training records in my whole battalion. because they started to care. And what I found was they had kind of gotten out of the big picture of the fire department while kind of operating all on their own. And I think that's what happens sometimes is when we let that gate open is we really don't keep people on track to what needs to be done, like right here, right now. They start doing their own agendas. And so we need to almost close the gate. And how that kind of personally is, when I'm not being vigilant about what's happening around me and I'm not allowing, you know, not creating a space that's supporting me, then I kind of do the same thing. I open this gate that takes it in directions that aren't really supportive of me. And I need to close that gate down and then, you know, and really refine my boundaries of where I want to be in my life and what I want around in my life.
Well, I think that's the bottom line, isn't it? It's all about boundaries. And when we have no boundaries, you know, I think a lot of us tend to think about having no rules, no barriers, and no restrictions and no boundaries, the ultimate definition of freedom. In fact, it's not. It's the opposite. It's quite the opposite of that. And it creates chaos, which then ends up, you know, making us less effective and less happy in the long run.
I agree. I agree.
Some people can exist, you know, with the no boundaries thing. It's not a hard and fast rule, but most people require some structure. And they're happier if there's a little structure, healthy structure around them.
And I think it's important to have some values. You know, I mean, I've had people, you know, I get kind of frustrated with people sometimes going, well, you know, just let the universe decide and all that. And I think to myself, I get sometimes that, you know, life happens and we just have to flow with it. But I also know from my story that I could easily just let the fire department happen to me. And I know at the end of my career, I would have been a very bitter, angry woman because of it. And instead I said, you know what, that's just not working for me. I have to say something. This isn't right. This isn't how things should be. There is a better way out there. And right now, for whatever reason, I've been chosen to be the squeaky wheel in this system. And I'm going to squeak really loud. And I started being that squeaky wheel that said, no, you know, women have a right to be here. We're good at what we do. We're a value to the team. We bring something to the fire service. It's a value. And I won't be minimalized anymore. And I won't allow other women to be minimalized anymore or anybody that's not being treated fairly. It doesn't even have to be a woman in the fire service. And I became that squeaky wheel. So in some ways, I do think we have to kind of draw that line in the sand of what we'll accept and what we won't accept. And then become an advocate for that change. Now, the key is to become an advocate without a big chip on your shoulder. And I think before those emails, I had a big chip on my shoulder. I really did. I was so, you know, those thousand cuts had hurt so deep and I was so, had so much armor on me that the emails kind of gave me the opportunity to reevaluate everything, take some of that armor off, fill in that chip a little bit on my shoulder, and become an advocate in a way that actually my agenda could be heard. And then once it could be heard, then they could start to look at it and some real change could creep in.
Exactly. And so what are some of the changes that took place in service in Las Vegas because of you standing in your power and doing just that in order to integrate women?
Well, now, I mean, when I first came on, there was one length of turnout coats, and so they were so long, they went down to my knees, so I had to usually pull them up, and using my strap from my air pack, had to use it like a belt so I could climb a ladder. So I was one of the first ones to request and actually get a shorter cut of a jacket. By the time I left, there was patterns for both men and women's figures. So that was a huge, big change to be able to have turnout fit us properly that actually allowed for hips and breasts and shorter statures and, you know, things like that. We got gloves in many sizes. It used to be medium, large, and extra large. We now have many sizes in women's cuts of gloves. Majority of the stations had no men's and women's facilities bathrooms. now, as I can say, as of now, every station, at least in the Clark County Fire Department of Las Vegas, Nevada, has a men's and women's bathroom. We have separate sleeping quarters, so you're not sleeping right next to people right next to you. You have a little bit of privacy. And one thing I couldn't get, and I was really hoping for, was a policy, sexual discrimination policy. You'd think they would get that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd think.
Now, they may have done that since, but I don't know. But I'm thinking, now that's the irony. I can get all this stuff changed, and I can't get that changed.
Amazing.
A lot of changes. And I think, too, the tolerance of what – we actually got some really good – finally got some good – sexual discrimination training and harassment prevention, preventative training in the fire service. And all of those were me and more women on the department, which is even a bigger change. I mean, when I left, there was probably about 35 women out of about 700. So our numbers were definitely going up, which really helped too.
That's amazing. So, do you have some advice for people who are in non-traditional careers that you would share with the listeners?
I would say you need to really have a balanced life. And what I mean by that is that I wasn't going to get my ego or my needs emotionally met through the fire service. So 10 days a month, I was going to work and a lot of times just surviving, especially at the beginning. At the end, it's not so much, but at the beginning, just surviving. And what I found was I was, because that was the only environment, then I'd come home and I'd be mom full-time or wife full-time and then go back to work. I really wasn't expanding that part of my life outside of the fire service, like volunteering and doing community-based things where I could get that fulfillment of doing a good job of, hey, we really value you. We want you around. If it's even a church community or a volunteering type community or even just sports, you know, or some kind of a really strong network of friends outside of work. So when you go to work and your ego takes a beating that day, you know it's just at work. It's not your whole life. You don't bring it home because at home things are going really good for you. So I'd really say to strike a really healthy balance in your life and make sure. For me, I always really enjoy volunteering, and so and I do that still. And that's where I get so many kudos that, you know, it's like, well, I don't even think I'm doing all that much, and they just love me, you know, kind of feeling, you know, but it makes me feel good. And then when I get those hits and got those hits at work, they didn't cut in deep because I had depth instead of just the one thing going for me. So that would probably be my biggest advice, is to really get solid. And then remember, one person can't be your everything. You really do. I mean, I would get a new friend would come into my life, and literally I think I would burn them out because I had so much that I needed to get off my chest, so to speak, and so much hurt, so much frustration that I literally think I burnt out a few of my first few friends that I actually got outside of the fire service to the point that they were like, I can't take it. They were running away from me, you know, and I couldn't understand. I'd be like, oh, they're abandoning me too. I think it was too much. And I couldn't expect my husband at the time to be that everything for me. So really have to get a great support system with a lot of people. So you're not always burdening one person or making somebody your everything with all that you're going through.
Well, I think that's some great advice. I have to ask you, Gina, if you had it to do all over again, would you make the same choices?
I would. I absolutely loved firefighting. I mean, there's nothing better than a great fire. I know that sounds weird from people that aren't firefighters. I loved fighting fire. I loved helping people. It was a great honor to be there and really helping the public in a way that, you know, at their most vulnerable times, to make a difference in a way that, you know, I don't know how I could have done that in another way. and been so satisfied with that, you know, and I'm like one of those people. I always want to know what's going on, you know, if I drive by something or hear about something. I want to be in the back. What's going on? So to me, it was great because I got to be in the back, you know, in the heart of it, the helping people out, the really being there and getting to do that kind of support when people really needed it. It's really a very honorable profession, and I'm really honored to have worked in that and been with some dynamic, fabulous, wonderful men and women that make up our fire service and emergency services. I mean, they still all make to what we could do at a fire, even to this day. I mean, what we have.
Well, you know, the firefighters are some of America's top heroes. So thank you for, you know, what you did, not only in being a firefighter, but in paving the way for it to be easier for women to be in that profession. So good work. And also I want to thank you so much for sharing your work with us tonight, spending time with us. I'm speaking with Gina Gelbach-Hall, and she is the author of Fire Gal, Rising from the Ashes. Her website is www.firegal.net. So really appreciate your time. This has been a great show. So thank you, Gina.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me on, and I so appreciate it. And keep up the great work you do. I just love you.
All right. And for the listeners, don't forget to check out the Awakening Zone store. You can just go to the top of any Awakening Zone page and click on store, and you'll find some great products there, DVDs, hats, ringtones, show transcripts, and much, much more. The Awakening Zone reaches the perfect demographic to advertise your book, your CD, your workshop, or any other personal growth development product that you might have. If you're interested in advertising opportunities, you can contact Joe Rombolo. His email address is Joe Rombolo, that's JoeRumbolo at yahoo.com. And remember, every time you buy something from our store or advertise with us, you help us to keep the Awakening Zone on the air and free of charge for both our archive and live listeners. So thank you for shopping in the Awakening Zone store. And I thank you for joining me tonight and every Tuesday at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, and I invite you to visit my website as well. That's jeanadrian.com. And now you can participate in both my Passion Power webinar as well as the InnerSpeak Breakthrough Coaching class at your own pace because they're web-based now. They're available for purchase on the classes page of my website. So you can learn how to find your passion and let it fill your wallet with the abundance you've always wanted. We have a great lineup of shows tomorrow on the Awakening Zone, too. It's going to start tomorrow at 5 o'clock Central Time with the Dr. Elizabeth Show, and your host is Dr. Elizabeth Lambert. And after the Dr. Elizabeth Show will be the New Potential Show at 7 o'clock Central Time with David McMaster. And following David will be the Cosmic Particle Show at 8:30 with Dr. Meg Blackburn-Losey. Now, next week, you guys are in for a treat. My guest is going to be Sunny Dawn Johnson. Sunny is a spiritual teacher, she's a psychic medium, and she's the author of a new book called Invoking the Archangels. And so we're going to learn how to put the archangels to heal us at the body, mind, spirit level. And now I'm going to open the phone lines. If you would like to call in and get a clearing, an InnerSpeak clearing, I will do that for you. The number is 714-364-4335, or you can come into the chat room and request your clearing in the chat room. And I'm monitoring both. And while I am waiting to see if anybody is going to want to avail themselves of the InnerSpeak clearings, I'm going to do one for mass consciousness. You know, we had a big eclipse today. We're on the verge of some huge change in our realities. And so what I'd like to do is just take a moment and surrender together and ask Spirit to help us in releasing anything that would stop us from moving into the new reality easily, peacefully, and harmoniously, because this new moon is all about huge new beginnings. So I'm going to pull one of the red cards, and let's see where, the red card says Veil of Death, that there are souls that are trying to get closure and or forgiveness with us
They need our help so that they can move forward into the light, into the new reality. Let's see what the setup is around this. So the setup cards are the orange cards. I'm going to pull two of the orange cards, and we will see what the setup is for these souls who need our help. The first one says they're stuck in the wrong place. They're stuck walking the wrong path, and they don't know how to move forward and move into the light, and they feel like failures. So that's the setup. The soul reaction is where we connect with these souls who want our help. So I'm going to pull one of the yellow cards, which is a soul reaction card, and let's see what that's all about. Ooh, interesting. So what this has done to the souls that are needing our help is it shut down their inflow. Their ability to receive money, love, and creativity has been shut down. What's happening for us in our world, in our reality, is that we're blocking our own flow. So we're not able to receive all the money, all the love, and all the creative influence that we would like to. So there's also a stuck belief that we need to acknowledge so we can let it go. And let's see what that stuck belief is. It's hiding right here. The stuck belief is, I'm not lovable. That's how these souls who are stuck, earthbound, are feeling. So let's do some clearings. The green cards are the clearing cards. Let's do some clearings. And the first card says, forgive all concern. So just take a moment, close your eyes, and breathe into this, and reach out to any souls that are needing to get to the light, and help them first to forgive. It's generally resentment or judgment that causes a soul to remain earthbound. The other cause would be fear. In order to release that, forgiveness needs to take place. So just assist any souls that are ready to make their ascension to forgive. Forgive themselves and forgive others. And what's holding these souls earthbound is it's a transparent membrane that's keeping them from seeing the light. So ask that the transparent egg that surrounds these souls be dissolved. And now call in an angel and ask for help. So look for Archangel Michael and ask Archangel Michael to escort all souls that are ready to make their ascension to the light. And just ask Michael to lead these wonderful souls where they need to go. Fantastic. And we receive blessings for doing this work tonight. So the violet cards are the angel blessing cards. So let me pull three cards, and we'll all share in these blessings. The first card says that the first blessing we receive is courage, courage to follow our heart's command. The second blessing we receive is a blessing of union and the acceptance of love from ourselves, from Mother, Father, God, from our partners, for our families. The final blessing is the return of our authority, power, and confidence. And it's gratitude that owns every clearing. So just take a moment now and give thanks. Give thanks to Mother, Father, God, to our angels, to our teachers, and to our guides. And I thank you for being a part of InnerSpeak Soul Adventures on the Awakening Zone. So until next week, remember, people who take responsibility for their lives create the reality they desire. Ciao.
You have been listening to an Awakening Zone presentation, Human Empowerment Radio and Media for the 21st Century and Beyond.